This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has gone heads up with the Israel lobby. But what kind of dirty tricks do supporters of the apartheid state have in store for her? We'll tell the story of the rise and demise of a reform school for Black girls in the Jim Crow era South. And a Black social worker and activist explains her plans to ramp up the struggle for Black disabled people's rights.
But first, the arrest of 7 heavily armed mercenaries outside the central bank in the capital of Haiti during civil unrest in that country last month has raised questions about the stability of the U.S.-backed regime. The soldiers for hire were quickly plucked from confinement by the U.S. embassy and flown out of the country and then released when they landed back in the United States. Haitians of all political stripes have a whole range of theories about what the mercenaries were up to. Jake Johnston of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research traveled to Haiti to investigate the case and filed an extensive report.
This all started on February 17th down in Haiti, and the police arrested this group of mercenaries, of contractors, a few blocks from the central bank with a large cache of weapons, drones, other tactical equipment. And so it immediately sort of set off this, really, I mean, this a political crisis. I mean, this is happening at a moment when there were mass protests and street actions demanding the president's resignation in Haiti. And so, it really added to that environment, right? And this was a few days where they were being detained and it was extremely rumor filled and nobody knew what was happening. And it was, quite tense. And then all of a sudden, myself and a number of other journalists, we were actually at the courthouse waiting for their first appearance in court. And all of a sudden we hear that they're actually quietly being moved to the airport, and then later realized that they were led by American embassy personnel through security and onto a commercial flight to Miami, where they were let go free of charges. And so I think, just to sort of give the timeline there, and I had showed up right after, and I was really there looking more at the political situation and what was going on with these protests. But of course, everything was colored by this event down there.
Yes, the big mystery is, what were they doing at the central bank? We have opposition leaders saying that they were trying to destroy records at the bank related to corruption in government involving the Petrocaribe deal, which is at the center of that civic unrest that you were referring to. But you also have the prime minister, who seems to have hinted that the mercenaries might have been there to kill him.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things that I came across and was able to sort of report out here in this investigation was a few things. And one, right, we don't know who actually brought them into the country, but we do know who they were working with once they were in the country. And that is 2 businessmen very close to the ruling party, and specifically former President Michel Martelly, including Jesner Champagne, who's been a close personal friend of Martelly for many, many years. In fact, Jesner Champagne was arrested on arms trafficking charges in 1996 in the U.S. It was Martelly who paid his bail. Right. So just to see the sort of connections there. And then, the other thing that really became clear, right, we knew they were arrested near the central bank, but it was unclear what exactly, role the bank had played in this. And one thing that has become clear is that the central bank governor had been in touch with these businessmen in the weeks leading up to the events on February 17th, the retention of these contractors. And that during the day on the 17th, the group of contractors actually tried to enter the bank and set off a sort of internal issue at the bank that involved high-level officials in the technology department. We don't know exactly what was going on, but that certainly raises significant questions around specifically those allegations around if they was destroying or altering records or moving funds or something of that nature.
What we do know is that the United States took extraordinary actions to rescue them. Rescue is the word used by one of the mercenaries.
Yeah, that's right. And I think for us in the U.S., I mean, that remains one of the biggest questions is what role is our government playing in Haitian affairs and what specifically caused the U.S. government to intervene in this case here, right? I mean, this was a group of American citizens arrested for violating local crimes. You know, it would certainly be standard procedure for that process to play out. And we haven't really gotten any explanation from the U.S. to this. I think what's important sort of context, again, to understand U.S. motivations in this all is that, again, looking back at this period of time where the government of Haiti has really been under siege from street actions, from protests, from opposition leaders, et cetera. And there was a real switch in U.S.-Haiti relations in the last few months. And this relates to another topic of Venezuela and the U.S. sort of real priority in the hemisphere at the moment, overthrowing the Maduro government. Now, in January, Haiti broke with years of precedence and voted with the U.S. as opposed to with Venezuela and voted not to recognize the legitimacy of the Maduro government in Venezuela. And since then, since that vote in early January, the Haitian government has clearly tried to sort of curry favor with U.S. administration officials and then, you know, sort of shadow Secretary of State Marco Rubio, John Bolton, and these guys who've been really leading Venezuela policy. And it's clear that Haiti has really tried to use that vote in the OAS to their advantage in their own political crisis. And I think, you know, that's really important to sort of understand where the different motivations and interests lie in terms of the U.S. response here.
Yes, if Haiti is going to default on its huge debt to Venezuela because of the oil transfers at low prices, they may see it in their interest to recognize the Guaido regime, the U.S.-backed puppet, so as to avoid default.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, one thing that's come out is that there are negotiations happening right now between the U.S., Haiti, and Qatar to do a debt buyback of that Petrocaribe debt. And, you know, I think that happening and those conversations happening in Washington the week before all of this happening certainly just raises additional questions. I mean, there's no evidence yet that there was anything planned in Washington or that there was any advanced knowledge, you know, of any U.S. government officials. And yet the sort of broad circumstances here, the broader context of what was happening certainly raised significant questions about who knew what and when they knew it.
And this mercenary situation seems to have highlighted splits or tensions between the government and the armed forces and police who aren't happy about what happened.
Yes, certainly. And I think, you know, again, this is why this case has really taken on so much broader importance than just these contractors' arrest and then rescue by the embassy, you know, really exposed a number of issues. I mean, one is the politicization of the police force. You know, this has been an issue in Haiti for a long time, but really picked up in the last couple of years, actually. There's been an open conflict between the director general of the police and the president, who's tried to get rid of him for some time. And so I think clearly this sort of exposed some fault lines there in terms of the police seeing if the government's bringing in heavily armed foreigners and paying them, why aren't we getting paid on time? Why are we being asked to do this? And certainly feeding into some resentment there. And then beyond that, too, you have the U.S. intervening instead of letting the Haitian justice system fulfill its role. Now, again, both with the police and the justice system, these are institutions that the international community has put hundreds and hundreds of millions, if not more, into in the last decade plus, right? And so to then say, oh, your hard work, your efforts is not good enough. You know, we're going to pull these guys out. They need to go back to the U.S. I mean, really a slap in the face, not just to the police force and the justice system, but also to their own efforts, the international community's own efforts over the last 10 plus years to build up those very institutions.
And how are the Haitian masses, how are they reacting to this mercenary escapade?
Yeah, so certainly there was a lot of anger and fear, right? I mean, there have been protests for many months now, you know, growing 6 months, and there have been dozens of people killed alongside those protests, you know, an increasingly worrying, right, situation. There have been pictures of, you know, alleged foreigners embedded within the palace guard back during protests in November. And so when these guys were arrested with this big cache of weapons, I mean, it certainly sent a sort of wave of fear throughout Port-au-Prince and throughout the surrounding areas. You know, there have been rumors since of additional mercenaries in other parts of the country, you know, much of which is unconfirmed at this point, but I think really speaks to this fear that this case has perpetuated amongst the population. And in terms of what that means for the ongoing protest movement, the result has been that things have actually quieted down some. I think part of that, too, gets to there was this big conflict between the president and prime minister. This is clearly part of this. Like you mentioned, the prime minister went on CNN and called these guys terrorists who were there to kill him. And that was seen very much as a direct shot to the president, right? Part of their own internal power struggles. And what's very strange is that quickly after that, Sayon has become very mute on this case at all. He hasn't been talking whatsoever. And it seems as though relations between him and the president have actually improved since then. And again, you know, I think just raising questions, what exactly was the situation? I mean, what changed in terms of Sayon to go from these are assassins here to kill me to everything's good and lovey-dovey between me and the president and we're moving on? Again, just serious questions remain about what really happened here.
Well, one could not have destabilized Haiti more effectively if one tried.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's sort of both destabilized and also sort of in the short term actually provided maybe some stability as people who had been fighting their own fights realized that they were had to sort of join together to protect themselves from the fallout of this case as well, right? So it goes both ways.
That was Jake Johnston of the Center for Economic and Policy Research speaking from Washington.
A recent congressional resolution aimed at freshman Representative Ilhan Omar, one of only two Muslims in the U.S. House, has focused national attention on Israel's unrivaled influence on American government policies. Omar declared that members of Congress shouldn't be compelled to pledge loyalty to a foreign government. She had earlier said that the Israel lobby's power was all about the Benjamins, meaning the vast amounts of money at its disposal. We spoke with Chris Hedges, the political analyst and former New York Times foreign correspondent.
I think Representative Omar illustrates a kind of seismic change, especially among a younger generation, which is not beholden, especially I'm speaking of American Jews, to Israel. I speak at college campuses all over the country. I often have contact with Students for Justice in Palestine because I'm also outspoken about Palestinian human rights, and invariably half of those students are Jewish. So we're seeing a crumbling of Israel's ability to defend and promote the apartheid state. And so what Israel is doing is because it does have such control of the American political process. It's bought off through campaign donations every senior politician in the United States from each party, is that it is attempting to discredit its critics in very nefarious ways. And this is, of course, what it did by going after Representative Omar, and they accused them of being anti-Semitic. It's very vicious forms of character assassination, smearing, blacklisting. I've been a victim of all of this against anyone who defends Palestinian rights, including the Jewish historian Norman Finkelstein, including university students, many of whom are Jewish, who support groups like Students for Justice in Palestine. And the fact that they are attacking these figures as anti-Semitic is tautology, but it doesn't matter. We also have seen the attempt, this quite successful attempt on the part of the Israel lobby to criminalize any support of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement by attacking it again as anti-Semitic. So you have 24 states passing Israel lobby-backed legislation that require workers and contractors under threat of dismissal not to support BDS. I mean, in essence, it's a kind of Israeli loyalty oath. I mean, you can see the power of the lobby in all sorts of pieces of legislation, including the resolution passed in 2014 by every single senator, 100 senators, including Bernie Sanders. And this was while Israel was bombing and shelling schools and water treatment plants and hospitals and power stations for 51 days in 2014, which left 2,251 Palestinians dead, including 551 children. They passed a resolution saying that Israel has a right to defend itself. So Israel has quite effectively held the U.S. hostage. It was Israel that pushed, in large measure, the Israel lobby that pushed us into the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in particular in Iraq. And any kind of deviation, even however tepid, such as Barack Obama's Iran nuclear deal, sees the Israel lobby go into hyperdrive. And that's how you saw then House Speaker John Boehner invite the Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, to address Congress in 2015 to denounce what was Obama's policy on Iran, which in the very invitation itself was unconstitutional. So the Israel lobby has long used its resources to control the political narrative. And I think that that is framed from below. We see it among younger members of the Democratic Party who rose up against the initial resolution proposed by Pelosi. And that resolution was written by, you know, the most stalwart kind of lackeys of the Israel lobby itself in the House, who just rose up and said, this is ridiculous. I mean, first of all, she never said anything that was even could remotely be considered anti-Semitic, but she dared to state what is a kind of increasingly transparent truth about Israeli interference in the American political system, which far dwarfs anything that any other country, including Russia or China, do.
Yes, and we talk so much about the Israel lobby, and of course that lobby exists, and as U.S. citizens, the lobby has every right to agitate politically, but all of this across the world is coordinated by the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs.
Yes, and I encourage everyone to watch the four-part series by Al Jazeera, which was never broadcast because the Israel and the lobby prevented it from being broadcast in Al Jazeera, but a pirated copy is up on Electronic Intifada. And it's even I, who follow this very closely, was stunned. Yes, you have a kind of open admission on the part of Israeli intelligence services that they are running U.S.-Israel lobby organizations. And yet, groups like AIPAC are not required to register as a foreign agent. So that is, you know, what is perhaps most disturbing, especially in terms of monitoring and spying on U.S. citizens, which is very well documented in the film, that is coordinated out of Israel.
So here we have the Russiagate tempest, now more than 2 years old, with an hysteria that says the Russians somehow, with Facebook advertisements, are conducting a political Pearl Harbor against the United States. And at the same time, we see Israel and Israel lobby activities that actually do target methodically members of the U.S. Congress, members of the U.S. government, and bring them into a public rebuke. How can both of these two phenomena exist simultaneously?
Well, because the first one is ridiculous. The whole idea that Donald Trump was elected because of Russian bots or the Podesta emails, which frankly, if anyone, including the Russians, had leaked to me, and I speak as a former investigative reporter for the New York Times, and also I would add the Middle East bureau chief, I would have published. My job is to find out whether they were true or not. They were certainly true. They exposed information that the American public had a right to know, that Hillary Clinton was in the pocket of the big banks and was saying one thing to us during her campaign and quite another to the financiers to which she was beholden. So the Democratic Party in particular is unable to address the social inequality which they helped orchestrate and which resulted in the rise of this con artist and demagogue who now sits in the White House. And so they engage in the same kind of demagoguery that Trump engages in. Trump attacks undocumented workers and people of color and Muslims, and they attack Russia, but neither is a reality-based belief system. And the inability on the part of the Democratic Party to confront the vast social inequality, which under the ideology of neoliberalism they helped orchestrate, is dangerous and may very well see Trump be reelected, because the people out who are have been rendered largely invisible by corporate media, and their suffering is invisible, and what's been done to them is not acknowledged and invisible, and don't really care about this stuff. So it's all, you know, the chattering of courtiers in Versailles, and all of them refuse to acknowledge the deep disintegration, collapse of democratic institutions, and rise of rapacious and undemocratic oligarchic systems that have destroyed the country. And so it's just another form of the magical thinking that envelops the Trump White House.
Much of the domestic support for Israel comes not from Jewish groups, but from the Christian right, from evangelicals. But it's long been clear to everyone that the evangelical right is also the greatest source of actual anti-Semitism in this country.
Well, that's a very good point, because what's happened is that Israel has now created this fault line around Palestinian rights. So if you criticize Israel's war crimes and oppression against the Palestinians, or Bibi Netanyahu's lobbying for a war with Iran, then you are an anti-Semite. If you cheer on the subjugation and oppression and murder of Palestinians, you are a friend of the Jews. And this has led them to build alliances with, as you correctly point out, the real anti-Semites who come out of the Christian right. So you may have within the Christian right, for bizarre regions of eschatology, that the end times are coming and the Jews have to take control of Israel in order for Christ to return and the battle of the Antichrist. But in that ideology, of course, all the Jews who don't convert are killed. So you can have the Christian right as well as people like Trump embrace Zionism, but they're also anti-Semites. I mean, remember, Trump is the one who's called neo-Nazis very fine people during the campaign. He tweeted a picture of Hillary Clinton against a backdrop of $100 bills with a Star of David superimposed near her face. I mean, imagine if Ilhan Omar had done that. And that's the sole criteria Israel now sets as to who the apartheid state sets, who in determining who to support and who to demonize. And real anti-Semitism doesn't matter. You know, the danger of this, and, you know, you wonder how Jewish leaders have just gone blank on their own history. The danger is that anti-Semitism, that kind of ethnic and religious hatred, that stereotyping, that demonizing, which the Christian right embrace, is dangerous, not because it's dangerous for the Jews necessarily, but because it's bad for everybody. Once you open that Pandora's box of evils, you empower, in essence, the real anti-Semites. The longer you refuse to acknowledge the very, I think, undeniable reality of Israel's interference in the American political system, the more you feed these people who thrive off of racist conspiracy theories. It's ultimately deeply counterproductive, certainly to the Jews in the United States, and I think you could argue to Israel itself.
Yes, we saw the international meeting in Poland organized by the Trump government, in which Netanyahu was hobnobbing with all kinds of right-wing figures who have historically been linked to anti-Semitism, including the Polish ruling party. And Israel is now cozied up with Saudi Arabia, the home of Wahhabism, which is as anti-Semitic and even anti-different kinds of Muslims as one can imagine.
Well, exactly, because, you know, the Israeli state has drifted so far to the right that in terms of their racist behavior, reducing Palestinians, most Palestinians, to misery in Israeli, well, let's call them what they are, Israeli-administered ghettos, that they have a natural affinity for other regimes, other authoritarian regimes that engage in that same kind of behavior. And it doesn't matter whether they engage in that behavior against Jews or not, because the rhetoric that comes out of countries like Poland and Hungary, of course, they talk mostly about Syrian refugees, which they don't accept, but the language they use, that they rape and they spread diseases, are almost word for word exactly the same language they used about Jews in the 1930s. So I think that the kind of tragic deforming of Israel as it has embraced overt racism, and, you know, let's be clear, ethnic cleansing and racism was always part of the Israeli government since its founding in 1948, but never so nakedly acknowledged as it has in this government under Netanyahu, who is, of course, running for re-election and has made an alliance with a very small but virtually the Kahana wing, which was the Kahana and this radical right-wing Jewish group was defined as a terrorist group by the United States State Department. And that is the kind of irony. But of course, the DNA at this point of Israel and the DNA of a country like Hungary or Poland or Saudi Arabia is very similar.
Representative Omar shows no signs of shutting up. She vows that she'll continue to speak out on matters of policy, which was what she was elected to do. Do you think that the Israel lobby will once again try to get a resolution against her, or will they see that as a bridge too far?
Well, I think what they probably already are doing is building a war chest and creating connections so that the next time she runs for office, she meets very stiff opposition. The Israel lobby has a very long history of destroying elected officials in the House and the Congress who in any way challenge them. I don't think they can pass another resolution, but I can guarantee you that they are now working with all of the resources they have, which are extensive, to make sure she doesn't have another term.
That was journalist Chris Hedges speaking from New York City.
There was a time not so long ago when young black girls down south were locked away if they didn't conform to white people's wishes or the codes of behavior favored by upper class blacks. Lauren Henley is a doctoral student in history at the University of Texas at Austin. She's doing a study of black female criminality in the U.S. South from the Reconstruction era to World War II. Henley found an illuminating case study in the poignant history of the founding and demise of a reformatory for black girls in Jim Crow era North Carolina. It was called the North Carolina Industrial School for Negro Girls, also referred to as the Eflin Home.
Eflin Home was originally established by a branch of the National Federation of Colored Women's Clubs with the goal of really uplifting young black women who have found themselves in rather precarious situations in urban environments. So these are young women who were deemed sort of sexually deviant, and that could mean anything from getting married without their parents' permission, to having a child out of wedlock, to going to a picture show unchaperoned, or even skipping school to go out and date. It really wasn't as dire as the term sexually deviant seems to imply. And the club women thought that by establishing a home for these wayward youth, that they could help redeem them and make them viable members of society. And of course, in Jim Crow, North Carolina, young black girls couldn't go to the reformatory for young white girls. And so black club women took it upon themselves to establish a comparable facility, but a privately owned facility, to really rehabilitate these young black women. It obviously didn't turn out that way, but in theory, the goal was to instill Christianly goodwill to make these young women find themselves in a religiously righteous space where they would learn vocational skills, they would receive an education, and they would go on to serve as potentially like domestic servants or farm workers or some other sort of working class job within North Carolina's, you know, local environment.
So this was a moral and vocational uplift project for the race in the context of Jim Crow. But it didn't ultimately turn out that way.
It did not. You know, one of the things I really try to get across in the article is that there was a major class divide within the black community in North Carolina at the time. And so these club women, they were middle class or maybe even elite. They were deemed respectable. They were deemed upstanding members of society, and the young women they were trying to save simply weren't. These were generally working class or lower class black girls. Many of them were forced to take jobs because their families were too poor to sort of make ends meet with just the parents working. And so you end up with this disconnect about class, where the club women think they're uplifting the race, the lower class thinks they're imposing an idea of middle class respectability. You get this tension where, despite the club women, and I do think they had good intentions, you know, I don't think they were really bad people, or I don't think that they were trying to impose a negative system on these young girls. I think they were coming from their own point of view, and the young women were coming from their own point of view. And so you end up with this tension about what is Black womanhood. And you see the club women promoting one idea, and you see the young women in Eflin Home promoting another idea. And though I think class is perhaps the largest issue that's at play here, I also really wanted to get across the idea that there's a generational gap. And that's something that a lot of Black women's history doesn't want to talk about quite yet, but we're getting better. And so these are young women. These are, you know, 15, 16-year-olds. And the club women are by and large in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so it's the same debate we always have across time about the younger generation versus the older generation, and what's appropriate for one isn't appropriate for the other. And we see that playing out in early 20th century North Carolina in this particular case at Eflin Home.
So we see these intra-Black class and other contradictions playing out in the institution, and it's all against the backdrop of a hostile white supremacist state. How does it play out?
Well, it's interesting in that when the North Carolina Federation of Colored Women's Clubs first comes up with the idea to establish a reformatory for wayward Black girls, and this starts in about 1919, they actually approached the Commissioner for Public Welfare in North Carolina, who happens to be the first female Commissioner of Public Welfare in the country. And Commissioner Voss actually seems agreeable to the idea that Black female juvenile delinquency is a problem in North Carolina and deserves some sort of state intervention. What's interesting about that is that there seems to be both an intra-racial and an interracial appeal to curbing Black female juvenile delinquency. Then, of course, the state never actually puts the funds behind establishing an institution like Eflin Home. So I think part of that is, although the commissioner seems, you know, agreeable to the idea, she is not the only one in the state apparatus to deal with funding issues. And I think as much as she talks a good game, the reality is that there is already an institution in North Carolina for young white girls. It's known as San Marcan Manor, and it's embroiled in its own sort of issues and scandals during the early 20th century. There is a home for young Black boys known as Hoffman Institute that already exists as well. And so young Black girls become this sort of forgotten space where even though one person in the state, one white person in the state seems to agree to the idea, in general, the state of North Carolina, you know, wants nothing really to do with delinquent Black girls.
And in the course of time, this place of intended moral uplift becomes, well, just a prison.
It does. You know, I didn't want to depict any of the matrons as particularly horrible or particularly sort of salvation-esque. Instead, I wanted to show that these are people, and these are people dealing with really difficult day-to-day problems. So Eflin Home, over the course of about a decade, really does crumble, and it crumbles because these are sort of layers upon layers upon layers of difficulties. So there's a funding problem that obviously means that there is a day-to-day issue with how the institution is run. If you don't have enough money to, say, buy food, now you've got to spend time growing food, and growing food takes time away from education. And so now the girls aren't learning the things that the club women had hoped because they're too busy trying to grow food. But as I said, there's a generational problem. And so as we all know, teenage girls can sometimes be a little rambunctious, and they sometimes just didn't want to work. And they would tell the leadership of Eflin Home that they, quite frankly, weren't going to work. They didn't feel like doing it. And as the article shows, they just ran away. So you end up with this compounded problem in which the institution crumbles both from within and from without.
And finally, its demise is complete in 1939. What was the assessment of the club women and the black community at large? And did the community see Eflin's failure as their own or something brought about by outside forces?
Yeah, so when Eflin Home sort of really falls pretty rapidly after 1939, in that year, the state undertakes this rather racially biased survey, known as the Psychoeducational Survey of Eflin Home. In it, it reveals all kinds of things about early 20th century ideas about Black inferiority. And so it says things like the young women at the institution are mentally inferior, which we know chances are they were not mentally inferior, but this was a way for the state to assess why Eflin Home was failing. Well, the psychoeducational survey really had negative effects on Eflin Home, the club women, and the entire state apparatus that thought about taking over the institution. And so the club women sort of get together in 1938, and they decide, basically, Eflin Home has become so tarnished between the psychoeducational survey, between young women running away, the lack of financial guarantee, that it's best to simply close the institution and maybe start again if funds can be raised. So they agree in October 1938 to close the institution on March 1st, 1939. And as one final push, which I perhaps find the most interesting little tidbit about Eflin, one of the club women's major proponents of building Eflin Home, Charlotte Hawkins Brown, and then another club woman, Minnie Pearson, penned this open letter to the people of North Carolina in the local newspaper. And in the letter, they say all kinds of things about how the fall of Eflin Home is not only going to diminish the Black community in North Carolina, but also the white community as well. And so they have this quote that I think probably epitomizes their understanding of the institution. And it stuck with me since I started this research in 2013. And it says, "Disease and delinquency know no color. The races on the lower level find each other." And I think that suggests this sort of class issue that the club women felt like they were up against, and that they believed that the young women at Eflin Home, who were by and large lower class and lower class whites, would somehow come into contact with one another if Eflin Home fell, and that without the sort of moral impetus to uplift their race, that everybody, white and black, would fall as well. And that ideology, I think, is what both contributed to the desire to build Eflin Home in the first place and its eventual demise, because the class issue became so prevalent that the sort of racial dynamics meant that the club women were too focused on their own sort of distancing from their charges, those young black women. And so in the end, you know, they pin this letter, it goes out to the entire state of North Carolina, and nothing happens. You know, they can't raise the funds to keep Eflin Home alive. It's quite clear that the community feels like the institution has not done what it was designed to do. And so for a couple of years, there is no institution for young black female juvenile delinquents in North Carolina. They are sent to local jails. And eventually in the early 1940s, the state of North Carolina does try to actually build its own institution with state funds on a separate plot of land. And that institution does survive a little bit longer.
And what does this story tell us then about the capability of this black misleadership class, if you will, to decide that it is the arbiter of what goes on in the community?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's a telling lesson about sort of the elite class or the middle class versus the lower class, and really says something about the inherent tensions of class dynamics within the Jim Crow South. I think we often will talk about a sort of class tension within the Black community, but then somehow when we talk about, say, Black women's history as a sort of subcategory of history, we lose that class analysis. And I don't think that that's appropriate. I think it's clear that as much as there are class divides within the Black community, there are class divides within Black women themselves, and there are generational divides within Black women. And so I was trying to show in the article this idea that there can be multiple definitions of Black womanhood, and those things are informed by class, they're informed by gender, they're informed by sexuality, they're informed by age, and they're informed by religion, geographic location, all of these things. And neither version or any version of Black womanhood is any better than the other. They're just all different. And in a place like Eflin Home, the version of Black womanhood promulgated by the young women and that, you know, afforded by the club women just happened to be diametrically at odds.
And these clubs still exist or have morphed into other kinds of organizations. Do these conflicts still manifest to that kind of degree today?
Obviously, the clubs have morphed into other sort of institutions. Perhaps the most maybe well-known or maybe controversial would be something like Jack and Jill. And I think in some ways, yes, these issues do still exist. However, I think because there is no longer the sort of legal apparatus of Jim Crow forcing Blacks to live amongst each other, I would say in some ways it ends up more diffuse or perhaps even more aligned with the sort of interracial appeal to an elite class versus a lower class, in particular along the elite class lines. I think there is an interesting space where you have both a sort of talent intense ideology that can exist and also a sort of separationist ideology that can exist. I think in some ways the difference of sort of early 20th century North Carolina is that these Black club women really fundamentally believed that they could uplift their race. And I don't know that we have that same sort of racial allegiance between, you know, the Black elite or the Black middle class and the Black lower class today. I'm not quite sure that it is as sort of racially cohesive, even though we know Eflin Home did not do what it was supposed to do. I do want to reiterate that the club women were not malicious in what they set out to do.
Yes, they were simply ineffective because of their own biases.
Precisely. And because, as we all know, you tend to see the world from your own point of view. And so the club women did just that. You know, one of the founders of Eflin Home, Charlotte Hawkins Brown, had established an elite training school for well-to-do Black children, known as Palmer Memorial Institute in 1902, which was founded, you know, 23 years before Eflin Home opened its doors. And so Charlotte Hawkins Brown would write all kinds of letters about Eflin Home on Palmer Memorial stationery. It was clear that she understood her role as a middle-class elite Black club woman to exist between this finishing school for well-to-do Black youth and this reformatory for wayward Black girls. So clearly, you know, she was in tension in her daily life trying to figure out, well, what do you do with these two different classes of Black kids? I mean, these are adolescents, these are teenagers, some of them are even younger. And she made it abundantly clear that a young woman who went to Palmer would never fall to become a young woman who goes to Eflin. And likewise, a young woman who went to Eflin could never graduate from Palmer. And that level of class divide that she embodied, I think, can still be seen in Black America today.
Among the top contemporary demands is community control of Black community institutions. Back in the Jim Crow era, Black folks did in fact control lots of institutions within the confines of white supremacy. But what can we learn in terms of our demands for community control today from lessons such as Eflin?
Sure. I think perhaps the largest thing we can learn, and perhaps the most difficult, is to simply ask, well, what's the community? Who is that community that we're interested in really controlling? And are the people within that community the ones who are doing the controlling? I think Eflin shows that just because people are of the same race does not mean that they are of the same community. And I think that is a sort of fine line to toy, to ask, we don't want to get so narrow-minded that there is only, you know, one tiny group of people who get to be defined as a community. But we really have to ask, is this for the good of that community, or is this for the good of our sort of own self-interest? And if those things don't align, as they didn't with Eflin Home, then what are some other ways we can really address the situation? You know, when some of the young women at Eflin would say that they ran away because the matron was physically abusive towards them, then we have to go, okay, so why does physical abuse and Christianly correction fit into the same space, even though they were never intended to be in the same space? Who let that continue, and why did it continue? And the young woman would say that they weren't going to labor. Well, if they're not going to work, then what kinds of things could they do to be more productive in a space like Eflin Home? And I'm not sure, based on the records that I've seen, that anyone ever really consulted the young women about what would be ways that they could contribute to the success of Eflin Home. They're always talked about in a really negative way. And I think in some ways that could be used, you know, a model very different from Eflin Home, but drawn from those lessons, could be used today to ask people within, you know, their own community, how best can we sort of assist in taking back some control and leveraging some control for the people who should directly benefit from such community control.
That was doctoral student and writer Lauren Henley speaking from Austin, Texas.
When folks say Black Lives Matter, Velissa Thompson wants to make sure they mean Black disabled people's lives matter too. Thompson is an activist social worker and writer, and a recognized leader in the struggle for the rights of Black disabled folks. She's the creator of Ramp Your Voice and the hashtag DisabilityToWhite. We asked Thompson how her politics impacts her profession.
Basically, social work has, in a way, three tiers. There's micro, meso, and macro. Micro is what we're mostly known for as social workers. What comes to mind as a social worker, we think of clients, CPS, DSS work, group therapy, so on and so forth. Micro is that engagement with clients, families, and groups. Meso is how we engage with institutions like schools, anything else that we're kind of in the institutionalized setting. And macro is what I focus on, is the big systems. Community work, politics can be higher ed, those who teach in higher ed, or do work within that sphere, do advocacy like myself. Those are the big system type of work when it comes to social work. When I was a grad student, I did a lot of micro work. I interned at a HIV/AIDS agency and a dialysis center. So that experience on the micro level helped me to make connections of what's going on the macro level. Learn about how corporations, particularly whether it's for-profit or nonprofit, engage with clients, the decisions that they make, and how that has a trickle-down effect on the type of supports and services social workers are able to give, and how those supports and services, particularly if they're dwindled, impact the client-family group relationships.
And you have a special emphasis on how these big systems impact disabled people. You yourself are in a wheelchair. You've got a disease called osteogenesis imperfecta. And
yes,
your focus has been on Black disabled people and how the big systems don't deal adequately with them.
Yes. When I started, you know, professionally, I started off talking to social workers about disability-related issues, because I knew from that particular sphere how outdated social work is when it comes to understanding disability on any level, when it comes to our language, the culture, how to properly engage with clients without doing harm. And that has allowed me to transition to be really more centered when it comes to race, disability, and gender, particularly focusing on the experiences of Black disabled women and families. So yes, that's basically been my focus since I've had Ramp Your Voice now for 6 years. That has really been my ability to go from a broad perspective and my teaching to a more narrow perspective to really center in on the Black disabled experience and the intersections and the obstacles and oppressions that Black disabled people endure. And also be able to bring my own personal experience in that as a Black millennial, as a disabled woman, as a Black disabled woman, as a Southern Black disabled woman, and bring all those identities and experiences that I have personally, interweave those into my work.
You created the hashtag disability to white. What you mean?
Yes. Well, it came from a conversation that I saw going on in 2016 about an XO Jane article about disability and beauty. And it featured the images of white disabled women. And when we talk about particularly disability and beauty and sexuality, it usually centers the experiences of white disabled people. And I came in on a conversation as everyone was talking about how this is another example of that erasure and inability to be inclusive when it comes to certain disability topics. And while, you know, being a part of the discussion, the hashtag popped to my head. I started using it, and it just grew from there. And it has really taken on life of its own and really to hone in on all of these private conversations that we have about racism within the disability community, as well as how that racism impacts the quality of life, the opportunities that disabled people of color have or do not have. So it really allowed us to have these private conversations done more publicly and without shame, and to have something that is tangible to really connect to it. So the hashtag been in created for the past 3 years, and it's been used widely within academia spaces and, you know, within the disability conversation discourse. And I was also outside of that, for people who are more conscious of the issues within the disabled community and the disparities disabled people of color face.
You're a little person, you're disabled, and you're a woman. Mm-hmm. But in 2016, mm-hmm. you wrote a poem that was titled, If I Die in Police Custody. We don't usually think of people in your situation being subjected to police brutality.
And that's very erroneous thinking, because when we look at the cases of police brutality, over 50% of them occur with disabled people. So disabled people are greatly impacted by police brutality. Some of the biggest names, particularly if we discuss the Black Lives Matter movement, were disabled, like Karine Gaines, Sandra Bland. Those individuals were disabled themselves, and it's very disheartening to know how their disability has been erased from their own stories when we talk about them, and how it's been erased from the bigger narrative of the impact of police brutality, and not making the connection as to how disabled people of color especially are very vulnerable and are targeted within this area. You know, people like me, being a woman in a wheelchair, a little person, we are more susceptible to being harmed by the police, and that's a reality that I live with and so many others like me do.
And you point out that the Black community is proportionately more disabled, has more people suffering from disabilities than any other ethnic group.
Yes, African-American, also Native Americans, we have the highest rates of disability. And those two communities have the highest rates of police brutality. So I think that it's very important to pay attention to how the disability dynamic really impacts how we look at police brutality, and how police brutality, when it comes to Black disabled bodies, Native disabled bodies, are being greatly representative of those numbers. And what does that mean to members of the community who are seeing this epidemic occur and members of their communities not really paying attention to that dynamic and doing more to raise that consciousness and to really allow disabled people of color in their spaces to be a bigger voice to this issue, so that we can do more and hold people accountable who are doing harm by us, and to acknowledge the disparities of Black disabled people and Native disabled people when it comes to this issue.
And if we're going to talk about Black disabled people and the state, we've got to discuss conditions in prison.
Yes, yes. When it comes to disabled inmates, and particularly those who are of color, the greater chance of them to either have their current disability exacerbated or for them to become disabled due to solitary confinement. So this is also an issue as to how the system is disabling people, you know, who are in prison. And what do we do for those individuals if they are able to come out? What type of supports and services can we give them? What type of community can we give them when they've been subjected to such harsh realities, such brutal realities, and us in the community in many ways being ill-prepared to give them the care and support that they deserve if they are able to regain their freedom. And us really understanding how when we talk about, you know, incarceration, you know, that is a very big disability issue that many communities of color do not think about.
Well, the Black Lives Matter movement is very proud of having raised consciousness about the queer community in the Black community and its relationship to the police. But are you satisfied with Black Lives Matter in general's response to disabled people?
I'd say there is great room for growth when it comes to that. I know there are activists who have been a part of the Black Lives Matter chapters, particularly when that movement began, who discussed the ableism that they did endure. Ableism is the social prejudice of disabled people. And, you know, it really made me aware of how our structures are ill-prepared to engage with disabled people, how our structures may either consciously or unconsciously be oppressive to disabled people when we are all seemingly fighting for all Black people. So I think there is great work to be done to ensure that Black Lives Matter and other anti-white supremacy, anti-Blackness, anti-racism movements really take a self-inventory to see, are they conscious of disability issues? Are they welcoming to disabled people who want to join the effort? Are they tackling the ableism that may be either consciously or unconsciously existing? You know, are they giving disabled people a table of their own or inviting them to a table to discuss things? Are they allowing disabled people to be leaders in these movements? Those are all the things that I believe that, you know, all of these movements, regardless of the Black Lives Matter or anything else, need to take into consideration to ensure that if they're going to say that all Black Lives Matter, that they really mean everyone and not just those who are able-bodied, neurotypical. We include all Black people, especially, and really take into consideration the disparities that we do endure that is greatly influenced by our disability status and can be exacerbated by that status. So I think there's work that can be done, you know, within these movements to really be more inclusive, opening, respectful, and knowledgeable and proactive about disability rights and disability justice within their framework.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.